Happy Mother's Day. I think it's a great day to be here to talk about women and girls. And before we do that, I would just like to honor my mother, who was a longtime member of this church, who's not here this morning. She lives out at Longwood at Oakmont now. But Janice Ramey was a leader in this church for many, many years in many capacities. She was on the founding board of the nursery school back in the early 70s, when that was actually a really heavy lift to get childcare, believe it or not. I was really excited to see that it's still going here in this congregation. And of course, childcare is still a really important issue for women and families today, but that's a piece of her legacy, so I'm honored to kind of call that out this morning. And I'd also just like to start by bringing both of my grandmothers into this space with us. They are both buried here in the columbarium, so it's very appropriate for me to just call out their names this morning and have them here in this space with us, Adelaide Gladys Hegner Ramey and Gertrude Elizabeth Snyder Geisler. So I'm honored to be with all the mothers in my life right here this morning with all of you. So I thought we would do a couple of things this morning, thinking about this current status of women and girls, and really what we have to acknowledge is the state of inequality today. And we'll talk a little bit about some data, some local, some state, and some national data. I thought I would touch on some key concepts that you might be hearing about in the media, things that I certainly talk about with my students. So we're going to touch on a couple of things that might feel a little bit academic this morning. And then I'm going to end by talking about some current, very local initiatives around promoting equality for women and girls in this region. So we'll end on a high note. I'll depress you first, and hopefully we'll get back on a higher note. Okay. Yeah. It's hard not to be depressed because this data actually is really pretty appalling. So let me start. Can everybody see these slides? I guess I wasn't clicking through. So that's our agenda for this morning. I have to click in two places. We're going to do this. So we'll talk about gender inequality. So let's take a look at some of this data. This is some of the international data to get us started. The World Economic Forum actually releases every year the status of women internationally and compares us on the Global Gender Gap Index. And according to their rankings, the U.S. is barely on the top 50. We rank number 49 out of countries. And that might surprise you, because I think we often imagine that the United States is a fairly progressive place, that we've done a lot of work in this area. In large part, we are so far behind on the international stage because of women's health outcomes. It's one of the big reasons that we don't rank higher on that list. So we're way behind on women's health. In fact, if you just are looking at health, we're 82nd in the world. So some very poor outcomes for women in health. And we rank all the way down at number 96 internationally for women's political empowerment. So those two areas are the things that are sort of sinking us on those international rankings. And this is last year's data. We don't have this year's data yet. Okay. Wallet Hub releases a best and worst states for women's equality every year. So let's just sort of zero in now and look at Pennsylvania in particular. In fact, Pennsylvania ranks 44th out of 50th for women's equality. And again, a lot of people are surprised. Really, I thought we'd be better in Pennsylvania, right? No. Unfortunately, this again is based on workplace environment, education, and political empowerment. So those are the factors they're looking at, and they are putting us all the way down at number 44. Ouch. Right? All right, let's look specifically at women in politics. We're no better. We're actually ranked right now at number 39th in the nation. This is sinking, and the last I looked, we actually could be at number 49. It sort of depends on how you're measuring these things. Let me show you some of that data. We have no women in federal elected office from Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has never elected a woman as governor. We have no other statewide elected women in any of the executive offices. Only 19% of our state legislature is women. And currently, we have no women in Allegheny County representing us. So not so great.
We could be doing a whole lot better in Pennsylvania, right, in terms of women's political representation. And some of this actually has to do with voting. And I just wanted to mention this really quickly, and I talk about this with students, because we know we're living in a time when there are a lot of states, including Pennsylvania, have attempted to pass various ways of restricting access to the ballot. And any attempt to restrict access to voting disproportionately impacts women. And I can go into that at length in terms of why that is. But in every group that's most impacted by those efforts, whether it's ID laws or other ways of restricting access, you're restricting access to groups where women are disproportionately represented. The elderly, students, in fact, women vote more than men, so any attempt to try and limit voting actually disproportionately impacts women. So that's an important thing to remember. Well, think a little bit about business. I love this graph. This one usually makes people laugh. But actually, there are fewer large companies run by women than run by men named John. So if you just add up all of the Johns running large companies in our country, there are more of them than there are women. I mean, that's kind of sad. In fact, there are more Daves running businesses than there are women. And this is large Fortune 500, right? These are some of the large companies. This year, the same group that broke this data down did the same thing and looked at a number of industries in different fields. And sadly, there are more Johns and Daves running all kinds of things in this country than there are women. But this is a particularly telling graph, I think, if you imagine what that means, right, for women. And sadly, you know, I know a lot of us are in business and thinking about these things. We know better, right? And I think that's one of the things we have to remember. We know that we've got all the data. If you get women into the C-suite, if you get women onto boards, we know that companies increase their bottom line by as much as 15%. Companies know this. They're trying to do a better job. But we're still stuck. We're still not making that kind of progress that even companies themselves know would help. So let's look right here in the Pittsburgh metropolitan statistical area. So these sort of counties right around Pittsburgh, thinking about women in business. I work with the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship, which tracks this data. And actually about a third of the businesses in our MSA, in this area, are owned by women. So about a third, that might be better than we thought. But they're small. They generate only about 3.5% of all the gross receipts in our area, and they employ less than 7% of all of the people. So we're talking about very small businesses, which tends to be the kinds of businesses that women start. And there are a lot of challenges facing women who run their own businesses. Women tend to be a little more risk-averse. They tend not to go after capital. They tend to fund their businesses on credit cards. They have access to about half as much capital. That's another thing we've found. So it's very hard for women to start and grow businesses and get large businesses going in our area. And it's much worse for women of color. Much, much worse. So I want to talk a little bit about the gender wage gap and spend a little bit of time talking about this, because I've actually had people tell me, that's not real. There's no wage gap, or we could explain the wage gap. You know what? The wage gap, that's something that used to be. We don't have that anymore. And I am here to tell you the wage gap is real. It's very real. And I'm going to show you a few slides to talk about why it's so important that we continue talking about the wage gap. We've actually seen some improvements. So this slide, put together by the AAUW, shows the data going all the way back to 1974. And I usually ask my students to at least tell me what they think they're seeing on this. Anybody want to tell me what they're seeing with this line? Some improvement.
Very slight.
Yes, very slight, a little bit of improvement, right? We're going from about 59% up to about 79% today, overall, the gap between men's and women's earnings. Unfortunately, graphs can be misinterpreted, right? Unfortunately, much of that improvement, that line, that increase in this line, is because men are doing worse. They have been doing worse over the last few decades, and as a result, the proportion of women's earnings to men has gone up. Well, that's, of course, never what we wanted. Feminism didn't want men to do worse so women could look better in comparison. That's not the point. But really what we've seen in our overall economy is really a decrease in men's wages, which is a big part of that. And when we talk about the wage gap, you have to remember it's much, much worse for women of color. So that 79% or 79 cents on the dollar is an overall number. It's as low as 56 cents on the dollar if you're talking about Latina women, right? So, and it's also very regional. So if you looked at different regions of the country, this data can be very startling. So anytime we think about the wage gap, like remember women of color in particular, really important to think about them. And I really worry about my students, right? My college, I teach college, right? My students are graduating to a pay gap right away. It starts right out the door. This is some data, again, put together by the AAUW just a couple of years ago. Just 1 year out of school, women are making 82% of men's earnings. And that's pretty stunning. We're talking about young women today, right? I mean, this is 2018 that we're talking about. And in fact, if you control for all the factors that you can imagine impact women's wages, right? Well, they chose a different major. They chose to go into a different career. Maybe they're taking time off from work to have a family. Like all the things we know impact wages. There is still a 7% gap. So when the scholars do this analysis, there is still a 7% gap that cannot be explained really by anything except plain old sexism, right? There's something going on here that has to do with the fact that it's women making less money. And just thinking about that pay gap, again, it's regional. So in Pennsylvania, we rank 29th out of 50 states for women's pay. That's not great. That's putting us down in the bottom half. Oops, I didn't forward through the slides. Sorry, I've got one set of slides here. Here's 29. Catch up. Okay. Allegheny County data, women make 68 cents for every dollar earned by men on average. So we're lower in Allegheny County than overall. And thinking, again, about some local data around nonprofits, this data comes out from Robert Morris University. They look specifically at nonprofits and leadership. Women actually are in a lot of leadership positions in nonprofit organizations here and around the country, but they still actually earn only about 74 cents on the dollar compared to men. So even in the nonprofit world, where they make up about 3/4 of the leadership, still only making about 74 cents on the dollar. And this is interesting, even when you've got a really highly placed female executive in some of our local nonprofits, and some of these are really big organizations, right? Really large local nonprofit organizations. Women who are executive directors who have a woman board chair actually earn less than their male counterparts. So it actually matters if you've got a board chair who is a man. Men who are working for male board chairs in this region make almost $100,000 more in Pittsburgh. It's a kind of stunning data, right? So let's turn and take a look at, we were looking at nonprofit, we looked at for-profit, corporate sector. Here is some public sector data coming out of the city of Pittsburgh. So these are government employees, specifically working in the city. And again, we've got about 77% of the workforce is male. And women are only making 83 cents compared to men in the city of Pittsburgh. And in part, this is because of the kinds of jobs that women hold in the public sector. This is fairly typical for city employment. The largest departments in the city of Pittsburgh are things like public safety, fire, police, and they tend to be heavily male. Sanitation workers, right? Heavily male departments, and they're making more money than the women. And they're very white, too, those occupations. All right, so perhaps it's not too surprising, given some of the data that I just shared with you, that we have to think about poverty as being very feminized. So we talk about the feminization of poverty. And about 7 out of 10 of the lowest paid occupations in this country are really made up of women, where women are about 2/3 or more of the workers in those fields. So these are occupations, childcare workers, they're your clerks, your checkers, these are the
people who are cleaning our offices at night, very low-paid occupations. And women are in 7 out of 10 of those occupations, making up the bulk of the workers. And not surprising again, right? About 1 in 7 women in this country lives in poverty. This has a huge impact on families. We know that about 4 in 10 families headed by single women are poor. And again, disproportionately impacting women of color, women with disabilities in particular, really being impacted by poverty. And about 56% of poor children in this country live in families headed by women. So that connection between women, poverty, and families and children, really important to keep in mind as we think about the consequences of this stuff. So why? People ask me why all the time. Why do we have this? Why are we seeing this intersection of gender and poverty, in, you know, still in such a wealthy and advanced country? I always point to a couple of policy issues because I think these are things we could actually do something about. The U.S. is the only industrialized country in the world without some form of paid family leave. We've been working on this problem for decades. Some of you in this room may have been activists in this area. This is something we've known about for a really long time. Women, of course, still bear the brunt of a lot of the caregiving responsibilities, both for children, for elders, for spouses, and other family members. And we are the only country that actually provides no paid family leave. So you may be able to see this as a ranking of all of sort of our peer nations. The U.S. is all the way down there at the end with 0 weeks of paid family leave. You've got countries doing far, far, far better than us. There's Estonia, right, with 87 weeks. Estonia at the top, 87 weeks of paid family leave. So again, only one in the entire industrialized world without some kind of mandated federal level paid family leave. And another one is reproductive rights. And, you know, we don't even have to talk about the most hot button issues here, but we've really been rolling back even access to birth control, some pretty basic things that women have been fighting for a long time. We are not making forward progress, that we are seeing a lot of backwards progress. And we know when women are able to control their bodies that they are more successful economically and with their families. So some of this is pretty basic stuff that women have been fighting for a long time. And if we want to talk about abortion and access to abortion, Pennsylvania is really not doing well. We are in a crisis. Most of our residents in Pennsylvania don't have access within their own counties to any kind of safe and legal abortion procedures. So thinking again about the full access to women's health care, we're not in a good place. And black women actually face some of the worst reproductive outcomes in, again, in the world, here in Pennsylvania, here in Pittsburgh. They are 243% more likely than white women to die in childbirth or with childbirth complications. 243% more likely, right? So we're not really doing very well when we're thinking about women having children, controlling their bodies, and surviving, plain old surviving childbirth, particularly, again, for our women of color. Yeah, there's a lot of good data, and some of that, in fact, the research is being done locally as well as nationally. There are a whole bunch of things. Black women are more likely to be uninsured and so not have access to prenatal care. And when Medicaid actually kicks in during pregnancy, it's usually later, so women are getting access to care much later in their pregnancies. And there are a whole bunch of other economic reasons, but I think one of the most compelling pieces of data that we've got now is about the trauma of living in poverty actually has an impact on your body, and it impacts your ability to safely carry a child. And we know that that's actually happening. There's impacts on the babies as well. So certainly living in poverty actually creates trauma to your own body and to your children's bodies. So thank you for that question.
I have another comment.
Yeah.
When I regard shootings and robberies and what have you in poor areas of neighborhoods,
yeah,
that there's a huge post-traumatic stress. It's like
yes.
worse than the Army veterans.
Absolutely.
Because there's no let up. There's no reform after 2 years. And I'm wondering if that the women under stress through their whole pregnancy just is the whole stress thing.
Yeah, and that's exactly what, I mean, I was being very oversimplistic. Yes, let me repeat that. She's talking about the one of the traumas of living in poverty is often living in areas where you're exposed to high levels of violence and other kinds of things that create PTSD, among other, just the reality of living with violence in your community is part of what I was talking about. The impact on your body of living with that, actually, we know not only from our research with veterans and soldiers, but it's happening in our communities, and it has an impact on women and their bodies, for sure, during pregnancy and trying to maintain a healthy birth experience. Yep. So absolutely, thank you. That is definitely one of the things that we're finding, along with access to good hospitals, good doctors, right? Like all the things you can imagine that are impacted by having to live in a community without resources. So let's think a little bit about particularly women of color living right here in Pittsburgh, because I think that as we talk about poverty and women and inequality, we have to really focus on some of the people who are most impacted by these inequalities. And in Pittsburgh, it's really black women and in our surrounding area. So about a third of African Americans in our region live in poverty. The black and Hispanic unemployment rate is much higher for people of color than for whites. I'll try to catch up here. Our infant mortality rate is through the roof. Pittsburgh is sort of criminally negligent when it comes to thinking about the survival rate of our babies. We have much higher rates of diabetes. We have much higher rates of all kinds of systemic diseases. For people living in poverty, again, there's a big poverty connection here, but you really see this come out clearly in the data when you break it down by race. The death rates are terrible. And we're one of the least diverse cities in the country, which is ironic given that only a couple generations ago, we were one of the most diverse cities in the country. So a lot of our residents of color are now living in communities where you just don't have a lot of diversity, and that does impact health outcomes along with a lot of other things. Overall, black girls in Pittsburgh and Allegheny County are not doing so well. And this is some really interesting data that was collected by colleagues of mine down at the University of Pittsburgh. About 55% of black girls in our region live in poverty. And if you take away only one piece of data with you today, it would be this one because it kills me every time I have to say it out loud. But 68% of black girls living under the age of 5 in Pittsburgh are in poverty. 68%. So if you were starting life in poverty, birth to age 5, you know you hit school far behind. Health outcomes, all kinds of outcomes are impacted by growing up in poverty. So if you've got 68% of our girls starting life that far behind because of poverty, we've got real problems, right? So thinking of just, again, about inequality, I'm really asking us to focus on some of the people who are the most impacted by these inequalities right here in our area. And this goes on and on and on. If you look even at schooling, black girls in our region are 3 times as likely as white girls to be suspended. We have a lot of data on suspension rates, right? A lot of school data that demonstrates the way this stuff plays out. And thinking intersectionally about this, like black girls with disabilities are significantly more impacted, often suspended more from schools. Black girls in Allegheny County are 50% more likely than white girls to experience dating violence, to experience rape, threats of rape. They're 9 times more likely than white girls to know somebody who's been killed. Right? So this is actually what it looks like to grow up in poverty, right? And as we're kind of thinking a little bit about gender and sexual violence, you have to remember, of course, that women are far more likely to be sexually assaulted in this country. We do have a lot of good national data on this. About 1 in 5 women in the U.S. will be raped in her lifetime. So, you know, we've been thinking about the Me Too movement, and, you know, really has started helping us, I think, about gender and sexual violence. But the data is still pretty grim for women and girls in our country. Women are far more likely to be victims of domestic violence or intimate partner violence, we're starting to call this. And I'd like to just call out the fact that here in Allegheny County, we've had the highest number of intimate partner homicides of any county in Pennsylvania for the last 3 years. So higher than Philadelphia, right? Allegheny County, not doing so well when it comes to intimate partner violence. A lot of violence for women. And gender inequality is particularly fierce for LGBTQ people, right? So let's not forget, we've been making some progress in this area. The city of Pittsburgh's been passing some really forward-thinking legislation. Of course, folks can get married now in our state, but if you get married to somebody of the same gender and you come in and put a picture of your spouse on your desk, you could lose your job the very next day. We don't have protections for people in Pennsylvania, nearly where we should for LGBTQ folks, and particularly for trans folks. And trans women of color actually experience the highest rate of violence and homicide in our country. It's really a public health epidemic if you look at these numbers. So again, you can lose your job, you can lose your housing, you can lose far more than that. When we survey particularly some of our trans folks, this is some data that was collected about 2 years ago, you can just see the economic vulnerability, particularly of trans people, but LGBTQ people. Thinking about the unemployment rates, about 31% of people reporting that they've lived in poverty, a lot of people reporting that they've lost jobs for sharing their gender expression or their gender identity, a lot of harassment and homelessness, right? So just think about the larger impact of that, even on local economies, when you've got so many people experiencing these things. Okay, so that was all the really depressing data. Everybody's probably feeling like, we'll never overcome all of this. Okay. I assure you we can. I'm a historian, and I take a lot of solace from looking to the past, because we are able to overcome these things. And I take a lot of hope from the folks who have come before us who have built really great social movements for change. And I get a lot of inspiration, particularly from our Black feminist foremothers, who've perhaps had to face some of the largest obstacles. So I want to share with you a few of the academic lessons we've learned. And these are things I use with my students, and I won't spend a whole lot of time talking about them, although I'm happy to go deeper. But you may have been hearing some of these words, so I just wanted to share with you what this stuff is, and then we'll talk about what's going on regionally. So let's start with intersectionality. Who's been hearing the word intersectionality? Is this like you kind of hear it maybe thrown around a little bit? My students, remarkably, are now walking in day one and know what this is. And that's a total sea change over the last 5 years. 5-6 years ago, I would have had to start from the beginning. So this is definitely a word that we're starting to hear a little bit more. It's a concept that actually goes all the way back to the 70s and 80s with Black feminism. You may be familiar with this quote from Audre Lorde, who was a queer Black feminist scholar, who really sort of helped us to start thinking about social identities. She says, there's no thing as a single issue struggle because we do not live single issue lives. And the woman who really coined this term and helped get it into the scholarship is Kimberly Crenshaw. She has a wonderful TEDx talk on this, by the way. If you like TEDx talks, I recommend this one. She's a professor of law at UCLA and Columbia Law School, and she really named this and helped us understand it. So what intersectionality is the idea that we all have multiple social identities, right? So I live in a body, I'm both a woman and I'm white, I have other identities. I can't choose to sort of walk down the street today and just say, you know what, today I just want to be a woman and ignore my racial identity. We don't get to do that. Particularly people of color don't get to decide, I'd really like to just be a female today. Could we just ignore the fact that I'm also a Black woman, right? These identities intersect. And most importantly, as we're thinking about intersectionality, it has to do with power. So this stuff is about power and the way that power relationships work, because these are power hierarchies. We've got male and female. We have white, Black, right? To be very simplistic about it, this stuff still is powered. So intersectionality is the thing that forces us to think about, if we're going to talk about gender inequality, we also have to talk about racial inequality. And we should probably be talking about people with disabilities. And we should probably be thinking about other forms of intersections, because this stuff all comes together. Does that help? So next time you see the word, maybe you'll be thinking about the way this stuff fits together. Another one that comes up a lot in my line of work, but you may be thinking about it too, is this concept of equity versus equality. So we've been talking about inequalities this morning, right? How, in particular, gender inequalities. Equity is a really important concept, so I just want to take a minute to explain what that is. Does this come up in anybody's work? Do you talk about equity? Can, like, a couple people maybe talk about equity? I like this graphic for a couple of reasons. We use it a lot in education justice work to talk about equity and equality. Although it's pretty funny because it's a bunch of white boys that are supposed to represent all of us. So it's got its issues, perhaps, and we want to talk about gender equality. So if you want to think about the idea of equality is that everybody gets the same. We're all equal, everybody gets the same. Well, if you are thinking about these boys at the ballpark who are trying to see over the fence, right? Inequality, the littlest guy gets a box to stand on and he still can't see over the fence, right? The concept of equity is a really important social justice concept, and it's very simple. Equity just means that you give people the resources and opportunities that they need in order to be successful. I'll say it again because it's a really important concept. Equity means you give people the resources and opportunities they need in order to be successful. So if you're at the ballpark and you're the littlest guy and you need two boxes to stand on to see over the fence, you get two boxes. If you don't need any boxes to stand on, you don't need a box, right? And I've seen this metaphor taken even farther. In fact, if you really think about real life, some people are starting in a hole, right, as if they're standing in a ditch. And a lot of people have suggested, well, let's think about what it looks like when we take the wall down altogether, right? So you can extend this metaphor. But I think this one is helpful if you're just thinking about the difference between equality and equity. So we often talk about equality as a goal, right? We'd love to have equality. I think we just perhaps can agree, given all the data I shared with you, that we're not at gender equality yet. So equity is a really important way of thinking about what do we need to do in order to get to equality. Okay. And here's one thing that we can do and that we can think about, and this is another important concept that comes out of social justice work, which is centering versus inclusion. Okay. Inclusion is important. It's terribly important. We talk about it all the time. Where you work, you might have a diversity and inclusion council or an officer who thinks about inclusion. Now, it's an important concept. It literally means including people. We want to include people, right? We'd like to have women, people of color, people of disabilities, queer people. You know, we want them in the room. It's important. You can't be part of the decision making or the change if you're not in the room. And you want them to be the decision makers. So don't get me wrong, it's important to have inclusion. And when you don't have inclusion, you get things like this. This was President Trump signing a women's health bill last year. I don't see any women. So no inclusion, right? None. Not happy with that. So inclusion is important, but it's rarely enough. And I think that's the important thing to say, right? In fact, it can often look a lot like this is a stock photo, right? And you can imagine somebody setting up this photo shoot saying, okay, we need a woman, check. We need a person of color, check. All right? It's sort of that checklist tokenism that you might hear about. And you've got a few marginalized people sitting at that table in that photograph. And they're sort of acting like tokens for their groups. But look, it's still the white guy doing all the talking. Right? Like, who has power at that table is probably still the men, probably still the white men. So it's often not enough to just include. Centering is different. It's really taking the most marginalized people or the people with the least power and bringing them to the center. And the picture I'm sharing with you right here is an example of that from some activism around gentrification that's happening over in my neighborhood in East Liberty, where people have taken the folks who are being sort of pushed out of that neighborhood, these are often elderly women, and they literally have centered them in the conversation by putting them in the streets during some of the protests, to have the conversation with them rather than having the conversation about them. So you'll sometimes hear, nothing about us without us is a phrase, right? So always including, and not just including, but centering the people, allowing their voices to speak. And that's really different than inclusion. And it sometimes means the people with power have to step back and let the people who are the most impacted be at the center. Sometimes we can do the work of centering with the way that we program our speaker series, with the way that we build our events, the way that we do our programming. Having a whole month thinking about women, right, is an act of centering and thinking about centering of women. So these are important ways that we could all be imagining how we can do this work. To move us forward a little bit. All right, so let me just end with a few minutes talking about some of the things that are happening. Sorry, I get behind in my slides when I have to double-click. Talk about some of the things happening locally around women's leadership and gender equality to give you a sense of what you could get involved in or some of the good things happening. And one of those things is happening right at Chatham. And I thought I'd start by sharing this, one of my very favorite photos of Chatham University students. This is a suffrage parade all the way back in 1914. And of course, suffrage was not won until 1920, so this is far before we had the right to vote. But these are Chatham students down in the muddy, look at those muddy streets of Pittsburgh, fighting for women's right to vote. So we know this stuff goes way back. And Chatham's been doing this work a long time. You heard, thanks to Sarah's lovely introduction, that I direct this new program called the Women's Institute at Chatham University, and we're all about promoting women's leadership and gender equity. That's what we do. We started the program about 3 years ago when the university became fully gender inclusive. I'm excited to be at an institution that wants to continue that work and says, you know what, we're not done. We may be accepting all genders at our university, but we are not done with this work. So that's really my job. That's why I'm there. And we really work across the university, kind of as a hub, to hold together all the work of gender equality. So we get to do that work now in wonderful ways at the university and out into the community. And it's really working. I have to brag just a second, but we were just named number 3 on the top 10 list nationally for women's leadership. And we're up there with some pretty big names. So I think that we all here in Pittsburgh should feel very proud that we've got an institution locally that's really been recognized. We beat Sarah Lawrence. I can say that because I went to Sarah Lawrence for some of my graduate work, and I love them dearly. And Smith and Bryn Mawr, okay, we're number 3. That's really exciting. It means that we're doing the work, and it's having an impact. And we're doing a lot of things that you all can get involved in, too. I won't spend a whole lot of time telling you about everything we do, but a lot of our programs are open to the public, and I do invite you to come be a part of that work. We do a lot of education work with our students, a lot of women's leadership lectures and events and programming. This is a group of my students who just graduated this year, all thinking about women's leadership and gender equity. I teach this work. And then we do a lot of public-facing programming. And so these are all things you'd be invited to come to and join us anytime. We run a film series called the Just Film Series. That's Alice Walker, the Alice Walker, who wrote The Color Purple, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. She was with us last year as a speaker at the film series. So we run these monthly films with a panel afterwards, and you're always welcome to come and join us for that. You can find all of this good stuff online. I know everybody knows how to look things up. All of our lectures are open to the public. We have a number of really great lecture programs. I organize a Pittsburgh Gender Scholars Consortium. There are about 200 faculty members all over Southwest Pennsylvania that work on gender, women, girls, and I've got to sort of organize now so that we can talk to each other, and we have an annual conference, so if that's work that interests you, let me know. I'd be super happy to hook you up, connect you with those folks. And then on campus, I work with several really great centers and programs. So our Center for Women's Entrepreneurship promotes women who are starting and building and growing their own business. You're always invited to their programs. The next speaker is coming up on June 8th. And these are open to the public. We would love to have you come out. Or if you know somebody or are a woman business owner, we have lots and lots of programs for you. Part of that is our Chatham Women's Business Center, which is partly funded by the Small Business Administration. And it was just named the number one women's business center in the country. So I'm bragging, of course, but I'm sharing this with you to let you know these are remarkable resources we have right here in Pittsburgh. So this is pretty great stuff that's happening at Chatham. And again, all of this stuff is free. It's hosted in the community. It's all out there to help women get their businesses growing and help our economy. We also have an amazing Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics, which is a nonpartisan, sort of bipartisan center that's really focused on getting more women into elected office. We've got a big annual talk that's given every year, and the amazing Doris Kearns Goodwin was just on our campus. She's, of course, a presidential scholar and author, and many of you see her on television all the time. She was amazing and wonderful, and our students got to meet her, and she's lovely. The Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics also runs campaign training, so if you know about people running for office, we would love to help train them. And women getting involved in campaigns has skyrocketed in the last 18 months. That should hopefully make all of us feel a little better. But that is data that I can share with you just from this campaign training that our Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics does. And I'll just tell you about a couple things happening in the community that I happen to be involved in. Pittsburgh actually has a brand new gender equity commission, and I'm seated now as a commissioner on this commission. We're going to be looking at all city functions and thinking about gender equality. And we're going to be using intersectionality and centering and equity, all those things we just talked about. That's sort of our lens. And we're really going to be thinking about how do we promote equality, gender equality in the city of Pittsburgh. So I'm really excited about this new commission, and I'm so honored to be a part of it. And another fun thing happening in the city, I think this is fun. I'm very interested in the fact that we have no women on public art in the city. And back in the fall when we were talking about taking down the Stephen Foster Memorial, everybody was talking about taking down statues, I actually wrote a piece for the Post-Gazette and said, you know, how about if we talk about putting up art? And if we do that, how about if we talk about putting some women on art? The city has no statues, none, not a single one of women. So I nominated 7 women, and I started with women of color. And I did it for all the reasons we just talked about, right? You need to start with the most marginalized people. We have amazing women of color. The history and the legacy of black women in the city is incredible. So I nominated 7 women. The mayor got very excited and said, let's make it happen. Let's do it. So I'm really pleased to report that there will be a statue going up in Oakland, the very first one. You can vote. All of you may go to the website and vote. You can look it up or I can give it to you. You can vote for one of the 7 people I nominated, or you can nominate somebody else if you'd like. And we hope it's just the start. And of course, representation matters, right? We want our kids to be able to see themselves on art and on the way that we honor and memorialize and remember the important people of Pittsburgh. So that is happening. And last but not least, I'm super excited to report that the Three Rivers Film Festival will feature all women directors this year. So they just reached out to me to chair the selection committee, and we just finished that work. I was very honored. I've written a little essay about why that's important, but I think all of you could write that essay now because you've heard me talk this morning about why it's terribly important that we have an entire festival full of work made by women. So I'm very, very proud of Pittsburgh filmmakers for that. It'll be the first week of June. It's in alignment with the Three Rivers Arts Festival this year. So there'll be an entire festival really spotlighting women directors. So those are all some really great examples, I think, of the way that we can do gender equity work in the city, the way that we can use our resources and our time and our energy to really think about how to put forward an agenda that advances women's equality. And I invite you to stay in touch. Please feel free to be in touch with me via email or come and visit or come to our programs. I'd like to follow up with anybody, and I certainly hope that you will continue thinking about some of the things we've talked about this morning, and I'm happy to answer questions. Yes, please.
So, I don't know how to get at this succinctly, but I've become aware recently of what's called tokenism. Okay, so when we talk about centering and inclusion, equity, and equality, you know, if we drop one black person into a committee on this, you know, in this church, what ends up happening is every time there's an issue that has to be raised, all the heads.
Everybody looks to that person, right?
That one person.
Yeah.
So that tends to burn those people out.
It does.
So how do you, centering makes sense, but how do you balance that with not burning those people out?
Yeah, well, I think you've just done a really important piece of work by acknowledging the problem, right? By talking it, you know, and saying it out loud, because so often that's not acknowledged, and so often it's either the woman at the table. I'm sure you've seen this in business settings, in other places over the years, where it's either the person of color or the woman, or maybe it's a woman of color and she gets to do the job of, you know, representing both women and people of color. But acknowledging that burnout and that sense of tokenizing experience is real is a big first step for helping all of us try to address that. And of course, you can imagine in all kinds of committee meetings or places where that might be happening, where simply by not expecting that person to be a spokesperson for their identity would be helpful, right? So when you want to talk about race, like, it's on all of us to talk about that, not just the person of color. And of course, it goes right to the heart of trying to make our institutions more diverse and inclusive places so that we have more people to be calling on in the first place. And if you're talking about things like building a movement or social justice, right, where you're going outside of your institution, those are other places where we can be more intentionally inclusive and centering and bringing people in. And I think that, you know, our church homes are all trying to do that work and be very intentional, and it can be super challenging if you're in just a physical space where you don't have as many people to pull in and call into that work. Yeah?
I'm in the legal field, and it seems like this is a field where there are more women in law school, and some judges like Kim Berkeley Clark, an outstanding judge, was called to Washington to get an award, but is this real? Are women in the legal field really different from what you've just described?
Unfortunately, no. I don't have a slide on it, but I'd be happy to send you some data. The legal field is another one where women are really facing inequality. They are, like many disciplines, women are well represented and in some fields disproportionately overrepresented in either undergraduate or graduate programs. But then when it comes to achieving partnerships or senior level positions within firms, we know that within the legal field itself, it's still pretty grim. And there are different ways of measuring that, right? Pay, position, access to boards, those kinds of things. So we're seeing progress, right? Like, all of this is sort of progress, but. Why aren't we there yet? Why is this so, you know? And we've been training women in the legal field for a very long time. So certainly some of that goes to structural changes that we have yet to make in workplaces, family-friendly policies, you know, things that would affect men and women, for instance. So there are lots of reasons for that, but yeah, unfortunately, have to report it's not quite as great as we would hope it would be. Yeah, Ted has a question.
So it seems to me like there's a lot of resistance. We're in a place where there's a lot of resistance to equity and that push for equity, because there's a common perception that equity is, you know, pushing for equity is a zero-sum game. If women advance, then, as you showed in your data, men are slipping back. So, you know, how can we afford to put up with that?
Yeah. Of course, that's not causal.
But, you know, the alternative mindset is when everyone has a chance to prosper, everyone prospers.
That's exactly right.
We're not kind of there in public discourse, I don't think.
Yeah, Yeah, I think you're right. There are two things. One is that many people do have that zero-sum thinking. And, of course, if you think back to what are the lessons that sort of our feminist foremothers taught us, is that feminism was always supposed to be about helping everybody, not just women, right? Think of even this issue of childcare. Let's just go back and think about family-friendly workplaces and childcare policies. That alone helps men just as much as it helps women. I know my own husband, right, super involved in caregiving for our children. So a family-friendly workplace would have been just as beneficial for him as it would have been for me. So a lot of these policies that we're talking about, paid family leave, child care policies, other things that would promote caregiving responsibilities will benefit, and we have the data to show that, would benefit men just as much as it benefits women, but it, sort of that idea that you're going to raise everybody up. And we know the economic benefits. We've also got good economic data on this stuff. But I think you're right. There's a mindset that it's a zero sum, that if some people win, others have to lose. And I think we've got to help each other get past that thinking, because that's just, it's not supported by the data, first of all. But it's really not thinking about our greater good and helping everybody succeed, right? And that, again, that goes back to what equity thinking should help us think about. And I had a second thought while you were talking. The second thing you said was that when everybody succeeds, everybody succeeds, right? When we can help the people who are most marginalized succeed, we really help everybody succeed. And some people are more persuaded by financial arguments, and we talk about this in the economy all the time. But if you can get women succeeding locally in our economy, everybody is going to benefit from that. So if that's the argument we need to make, we can make that argument too. Yeah, thank you. There was another hand up here.
Yeah, an example of that is, I've read your book about the early childhood care that the Presbyterian Church
I'm honored, thank you.
Yeah. I really thought that was interesting, the insights, and you even pointed out some white biases in the how they manage some of the institutes. And I learned that it wasn't really orphans who, it was like a boarding school for working parents.
Yeah, yeah.
For their kids.
I'm honored you read my book. She's referring to...
I didn't buy it.
It's in the library. You don't have to buy it. It's in the library. Because I went to the library and begged them. I said, you have to put this book in your library. Thank you for reading it. One of my first book is about the history of child care and thinking about orphanages as a form of child care. And one of the orphanages that I was tracking was actually run by the Presbyterian Church, by the United Presbyterians at the time. And its sister orphanage, which was called the Home for Colored Children, which was for children of color. So thinking about those institutions as an early form of child care, you might tell that I'm particularly interested in this issue, but I have been for a long time. But definitely, those were women who recognized a great need in our society to help what were mostly single parents dealing with a child care crisis. So most orphans, and this has been true for our whole history, if you're interested in the history of orphanages and child care, most orphanages were full of children of working parents.
I thought you also said something interesting, that these problems that were being met by the nonprofit people, private sector, became so huge that it was taken over by the government sector. And then, so that sort of thwarted the issues and the efforts of the private sector.
Yeah, you're referring to the period in our history of sort of, we built a lot of institutions in the late 19th and early 20th century, hospitals, elder care, homes, all kinds of, including orphanages. And those institutions, as they grew, and particularly as women started to lobby for resources for those, really, and this is part of the progressive movement, if you're a student of history and like this stuff, this is sort of early 20th century history, where women in particular started to lobby state legislatures for resources to help support these institutions, and really started to develop more of an expectation of our government for supporting what became the nonprofit sector. So places like the United Way, which was the community chest that started doing community fundraising for nonprofits, starts to develop this sort of relationship with the state to try to basically provide resources, right? Those nonprofit organizations could never meet the demands of what was really the outcome of living in, you know, imagine Pittsburgh in the 19th century, what it was like to be a working family in industrial Pittsburgh. So we'll have to come back and do a whole other talk on industrial era Pittsburgh, women, families, and the move to federally and state-supported nonprofits. Check, check, check. All right, Sarah, we'll put those on the list for future. Yes, please.
So you mentioned a word there a couple of times that I really thought about in terms of intersectionality.
Yeah.
But the notion of family has changed an awful lot in my lifetime. You know, I think back to the days of black and white TV, what got pictured as a family is not something I think we don't see very much anymore. Could you talk about that a little bit? Because that has had a profound effect on women from a cultural perspective.
Sure. And in fact, what you were talking about, sort of those the TV representations of family probably were never terribly accurate and representative of actual American families to start with. So if we're thinking about changes to the American family, there's certainly data that shows some of those shifts, but they might not be as surprising as you think. We have had, even thinking about the families that were using orphanages, these were mostly single parents, either men or women. Perhaps because of divorce. I mean, divorce is something that's changed, but we had an awful lot of plain old abandonment, particularly of men leaving families because it was just too darn hard to live up to all those obligations and responsibilities. Alcoholism and drug use impacting families, right? That's actually nothing new. We've got a whole lot of history on those kinds of things all the way back into the 19th century, if you want to even think about Pittsburgh history. And the impact of work and labor and changes to labor and what that's done is another piece of what's happened to families. But yeah, that sort of 1950s Leave It to Beaver, like who, right, probably never really was representative of a whole lot of our families. I think we like to think that that's the golden age of family, but.
It is how we're represented, it's sort of an ideal.
Absolutely.
And I think that ideal has changed
as directed. Yeah. In reality, may never have supported that. But certainly lots of things impacting families today, including the fact that it's now really mostly necessary to have two working parents to support children because of the changes in our economy. So we could talk a lot about family history and income and a lot of the different impacts on families, for sure. Well, it's certainly been lovely to be with you on Mother's Day and thinking about families, the continued importance of mothers, of course. So happy Mother's Day to all of you, and thank you for having me.